From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the great jazz drummer Elvin Jones, best known for his work with John Coltrane. Jones died Tuesday at the age of 76. Also, volume one of a 25-book series collecting the entire Peanuts comic strip has just been published. We listen back to an interview with the strip's creator, Charles Schulz. Film critic David Edelstein reviews Shrek 2, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead celebrates the 100th birthday of the great stride pianist Fats Waller. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Iraq today, American troops battled Shiite militiamen in heavy fighting in the city of Karbala. NPR's Eric Westervelt has the latest.
A U.S. military official says 18 militiamen backing Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr were killed in the fierce firefight in the holy city. The military says fighting started when insurgents fired rocket-propelled grenades at 1st Armored Division tanks on patrol. The U.S. tanks fired back and later called in AC-130 gunships to attack with greater precision than the heavy armor. Much of the fighting took place near holy sites sacred to Shiites, sites the U.S. says Sadr forces are using as firing positions. And in the northern city of Kirkuk Friday, U.S. and Iraqi troops detained Sadr's main representative there and arrested 15 others for alleged involvement in recent bombings, including an attack in an open-air market that killed four people. Meantime, in Baghdad last night, a U.S. soldier was killed by a roadside bomb. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Baghdad.
More than 450 Iraqi inmates were released from the U.S. military's Abu Ghraib prison today. A convoy of at least six buses took the detainees to several areas, including Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. The prison is still believed to hold as many as 4,000 people. The release coincided with the release of new pictures of U.S. soldiers abusing inmates at the prison. The Washington Post printed excerpts from what it said was secret testimony by the inmates. Some told of being beaten, threatened by dogs, and forced to retrieve their food after it was thrown into a toilet. U.S. military officials say criminal investigations have been opened in at least 37 deaths of people who died in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. John Kerry, the Democratic Party's presumptive presidential nominee, is considering delaying accepting the nomination at the party's July convention. The unprecedented move would allow him to keep spending and raising money at a pace with President Bush, NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Both Kerry and the president are expected to use federal funding of some $75 million in the general election campaign, money that comes after the nominees have formally been chosen. But the Democratic convention is at the end of July, while the Republicans come some 5 weeks later. That means Kerry would begin using up the $75 million that much sooner than Mr. Bush. By putting off his formal acceptance of the nomination, Kerry could also continue to raise money, which he's been doing at a record pace for Democrats, especially using the Internet. A Kerry spokeswoman says the campaign won't fight with one hand behind its back and is looking at this and other options very seriously. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 29 points to close at 99.66 in active trading. Advancing issues led declines by more than 2-1. The Nasdaq gained 15. This is NPR News. An Army soldier convicted of desertion from the Iraq War was sentenced to a year in jail and a bad conduct discharge today at Fort Stewart, Georgia. Susanna Capelluto reports from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Camilo Mejia did not return to his unit in Iraq after a two-week furlough last October. He turned himself into the Army 5 months later. Mejia said he did not want to fight a war for oil and is seeking status as a conscientious objector. He had been a staff sergeant in the Florida National Guard. As part of his sentence, the 28-year-old soldier's rank has been reduced to that of private. Before the sentencing, he told the military jury of four officers and four enlisted soldiers that he's not sorry for refusing to return to a war he no longer believes is just. He told them that he had no regrets, not one. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capelluto in Atlanta.
Israeli tanks and troops withdrew to the outskirts of the Palestinian refugee camp at Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip today. The Israeli military said it was merely shifting its troops and that it would continue to search for tunnels it says are being used to smuggle weapons and explosives under the border from Egypt. Dozens of houses in the camp were flattened by military bulldozers or damaged by Israeli tanks. Israeli military officials say no tunnels have been found in the current offensive, although they say about 90 have been found in the area over the past 4 years. An Israeli army spokeswoman said the offensive would continue as long as necessary. In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 15 points to close at 1912. The S&P 500 was up 4 points. It closed at 1,093. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR shop celebrates dads and grads with a variety of gift ideas selected with the discerning public radio fan in mind at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we remember drummer Elvin Jones, who died Tuesday at the age of 76 following a long period of failing health. Jones was one of the greatest and most original drummers in the history of jazz. His most influential work was with John Coltrane from 1960 to 66. Jazz critic Francis Davis wrote this about Elvin Jones for The Village Voice. It was the complexity of his own subdivisions, the artful suggestion of triple meter over a basic four that kept you riveted after the shock wore off. He was the drummer most crucial to the evolution of jazz in the period following bop, and you feel sorry for the generations who will know him only from his recordings, denied the thrill of watching him in action. After leaving the John Coltrane Quartet, Jones led a number of small groups known as the Elvin Jones Jazz Machine. His career lasted over 50 years. Terry Gross spoke with Elvin Jones in 1998, shortly after his 70th birthday. Before speaking about his work as a drummer, they talked about his childhood and his family. Jones was born into what would become one of the most celebrated families in jazz. His older brother, Hank Jones, is a distinguished pianist. His brother, Thad, who died in 1986, was a cornetist, arranger, and bandleader. Elvin's first recording as a leader, made in 1961, featured both of them.
I've wanted to play since I was 2 years old. Mm-hmm. And I've always wanted to play drums. I've never really wanted to play another instrument. You know, we had a piano, and Hank had an older sister who played piano as well. She was a classical pianist. And Hank, you know, all the rest of the... my other brothers and sisters all... everybody took piano lessons and... they could do something, at least play the scales.
How did you know that it was drums for you?
Because I saw them. I used to see the circuses. Ringling Brothers. We lived in a place in Pontiac, Michigan, where right in front of our house was a huge, great open field, I guess about, you know, maybe 1,000 acres or so. And it was just where all the circuses used to come and they passed right by our house to you know, with all the elephants and, you know, zebras and horses and all of that, camels and all these things. I just used to see them when I was a little boy. And And I'd see they would always have a circus parade, basically. And I just got fascinated with the drums, with the percussion. I'd watch the drummers, you know. They'd be dressed up in these fancy, beautiful uniforms. I thought it was similar to the uniforms I used to wear when I started playing in a high school band. But I guess that started me off. So I was just enraptured with that, and I always, and I would follow that band for a mile or so, and just to walk next to the drummers.
You were in the marching band in school, weren't you?
Oh yes.
Do you think that the kind of parade drumming and marching band drumming that you were so fond of as a child affected your drumming later in life?
Well, certainly I developed a good sense of time, because one had to march. And for the standard tempo was 120 beats per minute. And, of course, it does something to you. If you march for 2 or 3 miles and go out to play a football game and go through the formations, making letters and whatever. And I think it certainly gives you another sense of what percussion really is all about, and what and how it relates and how it blends with everything else. It's just as much a part of music as any other instrument in a band.
When you started to play the drums, what did you do to strengthen your hands and to learn how to coordinate your hands and your feet?
Oh, God. Well, I didn't start using my hands and my feet that much. I started simply with a pair of drumsticks, a textbook, and a drum pad. And altogether, the whole thing cost about less than $3. And it was not so easy to get $3 in those days. But I was just trying to learn the basics. I tried to learn the rudiments. I did what the assignments given to me by my teacher.
How old were you before you had an actual set of drums in your house instead of just a drum pad?
Oh, I think I was 21 years old. I had been in the Army, to the Army Air Corps, rather, and did my service, and when I got discharged, with the mustering out pay that I had, I borrowed another $35 from my oldest sister, and I bought a set of drums. That's the first set of drums I ever had. I was over almost 22 years old.
When you got out of the military, I think for a while you played in a house band in Detroit at a club where a lot of well-known musicians came, and you accompanied them.
Yes.
So that must have been a great way to get exposed to playing with a lot of people.
Yes, it was. It certainly improved my education a great deal. My main purpose was try to learn as much as I could about what the music that had fascinated me so much. Because I was in the Army, I was in the Air Corps, when I first heard organized, big time, what I thought was some of the greatest music I've ever heard in my life, on a recording. I heard Dizzy Gillespie and Big Sid Catlett was the drummer, who he's just amazing, this guy. They played Dizzy's composition of Salt Peanuts. And Sid Catlett played an eight-bar introduction. And it was with brushes. And I never heard anything so beautiful, so precise, so musical, that I was completely enraptured by that. And so I from that point on, I tried to listen to every record that I could possibly get. You know, there weren't many records floating around in the barracks in those days, and they're all. And even if they were, it was not so easy to find a record player to play them on. We had one, and you know the needles were all dull, but we managed to listen to it anyway. But that I thought that was just fascinating. I was just fascinated. I've been fascinated from that point on. I've never lost that enthusiasm. I think it's just the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard in my life.
How did you end up playing with John Coltrane in the early 60s? When you first started playing with him in the early 60s?
Well, before that, when I lived on East 6th Street, right off 7th, 2nd Avenue, and on 4th Street and the Bowery, there was this club, the Five Spot, one of the first Five Spot. And there I met Thelonious Monk, who was playing there every night with John Coltrane and with Shadow Wilson and Wilbur Ware, who was the bass player. And I used to sit there every night with hold a glass of beer for 3 or 4 hours and listen to that music. And anyway, that's how I first I met John Coltrane there. And then later he started to play with Miles Davis Band, and then I had occasion to substitute for Philly Joe Jones once or twice. And during this time, John was thinking about forming his own group, and he asked me if and when this happened, would I consent to play with him? And I told him I certainly would, and he only had to, when the time came, all he had to do was ask me.
Jazz drummer Elvin Jones speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Jones died Tuesday at the age of 76. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we return to Terry's conversation with jazz drummer Elvin Jones, let's listen to something recorded live at the Village Vanguard in 1961 with John Coltrane and Elvin Jones on drums. This is Coltrane's composition called Spiritual.
I'm wondering if your drumming in the opening of Spiritual, as recorded at the Vanguard, was composed before, you know, was thought out beforehand, or if this is improvised?
It was all improvised. We never had a rehearsal in the whole time that we were together. Not one time. Everything was improvised. As a matter of fact, I never really knew until I heard a downbeat exactly what it was we were going to play. It was sort of like that. You know, once you started to play it, and we just sort of fell, sort of rallied around the flag. And it came off like that. I don't know, it's very unique. I never had that kind of experience ever before or since.
Did you ever say to him, I want to know more before we start?
No, I would. I didn't have that much. I couldn't. He was a band leader. I thought he could play anything he wanted, and I knew he was capable of playing anything. You know, he could play the New York Philharmonic if he wanted to. You know, he had that kind of discipline. You know, he was disciplined as well as any other musician I've ever seen. You know, in any kind of orchestra or whatever, and so. He knew exactly. John always knew what he was doing, and he had confidence enough in the rest of us that we would be able to complement and enhance and make it into something that was tangible.
Now, you've said that the band would never rehearse. I imagine you didn't see any charts or sheet music before playing. Is that right?
No.
No.
It was all in our head, all in our minds.
When John Coltrane's solos got longer, and then your solos got longer too, I wonder what it was like to accompany him in like what 40-minute solos. I mean, that's about the length of a whole set.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'll tell you, there was one occasion in Philadelphia where you are now. You remember the Showboat Lounge?
Yeah, that was a jazz club before I moved here, yeah.
Anyway, we used to play there quite often, in Pep's Bar and all, and the Blue Note up in North Philly. But we used to play, you know, the routine was on Saturday or Sunday afternoon, it would be a matinee, and we played a matinee that this particular matinee. John was playing a very fast tempo piece, and something happened to his horn. I guess pad fell out or whatever, you know, and it was just. All he could barely get a tone out of was just squeaks and squawks. So, and he wouldn't stop. And so he played until he finally started making scales out of all of these sounds that were coming out of his horn. And he played this piece for 3 hours. But the thing about it is, when we finished, I was ready to play the next piece. I said, okay, what are we gonna play next? And the matinee was over, you know. So you're talking about 40 minutes was not. I thought the way that group was, I think it was the time didn't really have any significance. You know, I didn't get tired. Nobody got tired. It was just to pursue an idea or a mode to its natural conclusion. And if it took an hour or 40 minutes or 2 hours or whatever, then that, so be it.
Thank you.
What about when the music of the group started moving away from time signatures and getting freer? As the drummer, how did you feel about that?
Just like anything else, I don't think any. It didn't. It really didn't matter, because that's what you refer to as an abstract, and so it was nothing strange about being about abstracts, because I used to like to watch go to a museum in Detroit. You got a lot of Jackson Pollock's paintings, you know. And Matisse and Picasso and all these guys, that's all abstract, you know. I didn't think it was any different than anything else. It's just a musical abstract. But the portrait is there, nevertheless.
What were your brothers, Hank Jones and Thad Jones, reactions to your work with Coltrane? Did they think it was getting too far out? Did they like it?
I guess so. I don't know. Yeah, I know that they liked me, you know, and that's the main thing. They didn't care what I played. I'm the baby boy.
So did you not even know what they thought of the music?
No, I never. They always knew I could play very well, and I know I was a good drummer, and they told me that many times.
Jazz drummer Elvin Jones speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Jones died Tuesday at the age of 76. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams, available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. And by TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Charles Schulz. The complete collection of his Peanuts comic strip is being released in a 25-volume series. The first has just been published. Also, David Edelstein reviews Shrek 2, and Kevin Whitehead celebrates the centennial of the birth of Fats Waller. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. The mischievous fairy tale Shrek began as a 1990 book by the late William Steig about a warty ogre and an even wartier princess. Transformed into a smash animated feature in 2001, it's now spawned a sequel, Shrek 2. David Edelstein has this review.
It was weird to be maybe the only person on the planet indifferent to the original Shrek, with its eyesore colors and smirky in-jokes and fast-talking black guy sidekick disguised as a donkey. I felt like, well, an ogre in a sea of happy pixies. I admit that was a sourpuss reaction, because Shrek did have great stuff. The first scene, for instance, in which the uncouth bug-eating monster hero uses a prudish old fairy tale as toilet paper, or the evil Lord Farquaad's exhortation to his troops, which looks more prophetic every day. Some of you may die, but it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make. I wasn't prepared, though, for the blast of happiness that is Shrek 2. It's a leap forward on every level, beginning with the plot, which isn't another cookie-cutter odyssey. The movie opens with the ogre Shrek, voiced by Mike Myers, and his princess bride, Fiona, voiced by Cameron Diaz, on their honeymoon. In the last film, a father ashamed of the curse that made her a part-time ogre had locked the fair Fiona in a tower. But in the climax, she learned that it was the conventionally willowy blonde who wasn't her real self. Now, the lovebirds revel in their shared ogreishness. They're even unfazed by the pitchfork-wielding mob that tends to come out when flatulent green giants have noisy, albeit PG-rated sex, in the middle of their fields. The problem is that no one will let them live happily ever after as ogres. The couple knows they're in trouble when an invitation comes from Fiona's mom and dad, the king and queen, voiced by John Cleese and Julie Andrews, who don't realize that their beauteous daughter has not only married a mammoth, trumpet-eared slab of green beef, but joyously become one herself. Dinner at the castle with the in-laws is no picnic.
Bon appétit!
Oh, Mexican food! My favorite!
Well, let's not just sit here with our tummies rumbling. Everybody dig in.
Don't mind if I do, Lillian.
So, I suppose any grandchildren I could expect from you would be...
Ogres. Yes.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Right, Harold?
Oh, no! No, of course not. That is assuming you don't eat your own young...
Dad!
Oh, no, we usually prefer the ones who've been locked away in a tower.
Shrek, please.
I only did that because I love her.
Oh, hi. Daycare or Dragon Guarded Castle?
You wouldn't understand. You're not her father.
It's so nice to have the family together for dinner.
It's a shock when the king hires an assassin to bump off his new son-in-law, but a happy one when it turns out to be Puss in Boots, voiced by Antonio Banderas. The former Zorro stops the show by recasting the Mexican Avenger as an impudent feline with a weapon more disarming than a foil, a pair of schlock kitty painting saucer eyes that are impossibly adorable. Although Eddie Murphy's donkey warns him the position of annoying talking animal has already been taken, sharing that function is the best thing that could have happened to this braying ass. The issue in Shrek 2 is not how one rescues a princess, but how one makes the marriage work within a family and a society that has problems with what you might call the alien other. Even Fiona's sugary fairy godmother, voiced by absolutely fabulous's brilliant Jennifer Saunders, can't handle it. Behind that twinkly facade, she turns out to be a steely corporate creature and the mother of Prince Charming, who feels entitled to the princess. She hatches a plan to turn the young woman back into a willowy blonde. She's the true target of Shrek 2. She's like a Disney executive with firm and acquisitive ideas about what constitutes happily ever afterdom. You could say the film boils down to a progressive plea on behalf of so-called misfits to let them stay true to their essential misfit selves, a lesson in how to keep your head when those around you are surgically altering theirs. Fortunately, there's no need to boil it down. Just a frolic in the wave upon wave of parodies, songs, and stupendous visual and vocal turns. I still don't love the 3D virtual reality look. My taste runs to cartoons that are cartoon-like, that tickle your synapses by madly altering the laws of time and space in the manner of last year's Triplets of Belleville. And my ideal animated film would have fewer fast food tie-ins and more original songs. But that final rush of demented fairy tale revisionism, the Godzilla gingerbread man, Pinocchio reenacting Mission Impossible in ladies' underwear, the king who looks better as a frog, to resist it all, you'd have to be an ogre. I take that back. Ogres are a gas.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Coming up, the creator of the comic strip Peanuts, the late Charles Schulz. This is Fresh Air. Four years ago, a depressed, insecure kid named Charlie Brown took his place on the comics pages of the nation's dailies, next to Lil Abner, Steve Canyon, and Prince Valiant. The comic strip was called Peanuts, and its creator Charles Schulz died in January 2000, the night before his final strip ran in the Sunday papers. The earliest Peanuts strips have just been collected in the first volume of The Complete Peanuts, a series that's expected to run for 12 and a half years, recreating all 50 years of Peanuts in 25 volumes. The series is the project of Fantagraphics books publisher Gary Groth, who talked about the idea with Schulz before he died, then collaborated with his widow, Jean Schulz. After serving as an infantryman in World War II, Charles Schulz wrote a comic strip called Little Folks for the St. Paul Pioneer Press. When his editor refused his request for a raise, he quit and went to New York, where the first Peanuts appeared in 1950. Besides writing the strip for daily and Sunday publication, Schulz penned the storyboards for several Charlie Brown TV specials. Terry Gross spoke to Charles Schulz in 1990.
Do you think of the characters in Peanuts as each representing a different side of your own character?
I think there's no doubt about it. I doubt that it would be possible to do something every day with a group of characters such as I have without each one of those characters being a little bit of myself or being a little bit of the creator. I think this is the only way you can do it. This is why I suppose the characters do change little by little. I try to be consistent in their personalities, but I also think that none of us is ever really consistent in the things that we do and say. We all have our little good points and bad points, and this is what the characters have. I kind of like the theory that my son Monty has. He called me one day and he says, I've been thinking about your characters, you know, and I've come to the conclusion that Charlie Brown is really the smartest one of the whole group. And I had never even thought much about it, but I have a feeling that he's right.
What part of yourself is Charlie Brown about?
Not as much as people like to think. It just makes a good story, of course. I have not been the loser that Charlie Brown has, although I can remember certainly losses in both baseball and golf and hockey that go back 50 years, and I'm still suffering from them. I think Charlie Brown and I are alike in that we are both fanatics about certain things. I was the same sort of little kid that Charlie Brown was. I looked forward to the baseball games that we were going to have, and if it was raining, I would have been the kind that would have stood out in the rain and saying, where's everybody going? You know, let's play the game. Come on, let's go. You know, I was just dedicated to things like that. And I suppose it's the dedication to drawing that has kept me going these 40 years, because I am completely dedicated to what I do.
Do you get depressed like Charlie Brown?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I've been depressed the last few days.
About
I never quite know why.
About what? Do you know?
For one thing, we are in the midst of doing a wonderful ice show here at my ice arena, and there's something about seeing all the beautiful bright young people out there performing, and I listen to the music. The music brings back memories to me, and I suppose I'm just sensitive to that kind of thing. I don't think I'm any more sensitive than anyone else is, but they do affect me, and little things like that do tend to make me feel depressed, although Rita Grimsley Johnson wrote a book about me a couple of years ago called Good Grief, and she mentions in there my depression, and I think the use of the word depression is almost wrong. I don't know what word would be more suitable, but I don't think that I am what you would call a depressed person by any means.
Well, you know, when a child is depressed like or anxious like Charlie Brown often is, I think that adults sometimes don't understand it and think, you know, that childhood should be a time when kids are more carefree.
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering if you were exposed to a lot of that when you were young, of adults maybe not understanding your moods. and your interior self?
I don't know about the moods, but I think the word anxiety is much more appropriate than depression.
Yeah.
I think I am a very anxious person. Now, my childhood was a good childhood, but there were episodes in our neighborhood where there were some cruel children, a couple of boys, and there's one of them. If I ever see him again sometime, I'm going to kill him. they caused me much unhappiness, and I think this is something that adults tend to forget. It's very difficult out there in the playground to survive. It's a struggle out there, and as we grow older, we drift away from that, and we learn how to protect ourselves, but children are defenseless, and if they are forced to be out on that playground, and they are too small, or they're inadequate in some ways, and they just can't defend themselves, it can be a very miserable life.
Now, let's get to Lucy. Lucy has a Lucy has a psychiatry booth.
Yeah.
Were you ever in therapy, or do you have any faith in therapy?
I don't know enough about it to say I have faith or not. I went through a few sessions over this anxiety business, but the psychiatric booth is really a takeoff, a parody of the old lemonade stands that used to be in comic strips.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. When I was growing up, every comic strip character at some time or another ran a little lemonade stand. And so I was thinking about that one day, and I thought, well, nowadays it'd be much more practical to have a psychiatric booth, and that's how that all started.
How did you come up with Linus's security blanket?
I would say out of the five children that we had, three of them had blankets. And two of them carried the blankets around until they literally crumbled and disappeared. Little by little, chunks would fall off each day until finally there was nothing left. And that was the end of the blanket. And that's what gave me the idea for it. I was always glad that I was the first one who noticed it and used it, because I know if I had not, that Mort Walker, who was very bright, would have latched onto the same idea.
Your father and Charlie Brown's father were both barbers. Now, Charlie Brown has no hair. He has that one little lock that comes out.
I don't think of it as not having hair. I think of it as being hair that is so blonde that it just doesn't, it's not seen very clearly, that's all.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if your father always gave you too close of a shave
when
he cut your hair.
No, but he always gave me haircuts, and when I went to school, I was always looking very nice. My hair was neatly combed, but the embarrassing thing about that was when I used to go into the shop, and he'd be working on me, and maybe he'd be halfway through my haircut, and a real good customer would come in, and he would say, why don't you just sit over there and wait for a little bit, because I have to wait on this man. It was so embarrassing to sit on the bench with just a half a haircut.
Oh, yeah. What was the first strip that you did with a Charlie Brown or Charlie Brown kind of character in it? Did it start off as the strip that we know now, or was there a more was there an earlier version of it?
No, but the original submission to United Features was a panel rather than a strip, so there were no definite characters. And then when I went to New York to sign the contract, I took along a batch of about a half a dozen strips I had been working on just to show them what else I could do, and they said immediately that they would much rather have a strip than a panel, because a strip just is easier to sell, it's easier to market. So then they said, well, you'll have to create some definite characters. So I said, well, that's no problem, because I already knew I liked to draw a little dog, and I just went home and I asked my friend Charlie Brown if I could use his name. And he said that was fine, and so I created Patty and Shermie, and those were the four lead characters. The first strip that ever appeared, I wish I had never drawn. It shows Shermie and Patty sitting on a curb, and they see Charlie Brown coming from a distance. And Shermie says, here comes Charlie Brown. Yes, sir, good old Charlie Brown. And as he walks by, he says, how I hate him. See, that shows what I was doing those days, which I would never do now.
Why are you sorry that you drew that, though?
Well, I don't think he should have said something like, how I hate him. It's a little too strong. Nowadays, I think I would make it more mild.
Now, have you ever hired artists to draw for you, like most people who do newspaper strips end up doing?
I would quit before I'd do that. The only way I suppose that it could happen would be if I had a temporary illness and I simply couldn't keep up the schedule. But even then, I think we would just drop the strip until I became well again. Before I had heart surgery, I worked very hard, and I got 3 months ahead on the strip because I didn't know how much time I would lose. As it turned out, I only lost a month. But I hope that no one else ever touches the strip, because the strip is me. And this doesn't mean that I'm critical of others who do have assistance. Some of them certainly need them, but I would never want anybody else to do it. And my children feel the same way, and they insisted in putting in our syndicate contract that when I retire or die, the strip goes too, because they said, and I quote, "We don't want anybody else drawing Dad's strip."
Have you ever wanted to do a strip besides Peanuts?
Yes, I never will. I've often thought that I would have liked to have drawn a strip about real children, with the cartooning not being as exaggerated as it is with mine, with the larger heads and the little tiny bodies. I think there is something there. However, we are now caught in this terrible bind where we have such small space in which to work that it would be almost impossible to do something like that.
Is it loyalty to Peanuts also that would hold you back from doing a different strip?
Yeah, because I like what I have, and I think that every thought that comes to me can be used in the Peanuts strip in some way or another. I never think of something and say, well, gee, I wish I could use that, but it just won't work in my strip. I have a repertory group here that will accommodate anything that I can think of, whether it's something fairly serious, you know, like certain scriptural references, something from the Old Testament, way on down to something really corny, and then I'll give it to Snoopy, and he'll tell Woodstock something which is just absurd and corny, and they both laugh so hard they fall off the doghouse and land on their heads. you know, those things are really fun, and that's what cartooning is all about. I think that cartoonists have to be very much aware of their medium, because you cannot compete with live actors, television actors, movie actors, radio actors, on their own ground. You have to remember that you can do things that they can't do. Cartoon characters can flip over and do things that live actors can't do, but they can do things that we can't do. So you always must be aware of your own medium.
The late Charles Schulz speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Volume 1 of The Complete Peanuts has just been published. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead on Fats Waller and a new centennial collection. This is Fresh Air. Today marks the 100th birthday of Thomas Fats Waller, the New York Stride School pianist, singer, musical comedian, pioneering jazz organist, and composer of hit tunes like Ain't Misbehavin' and Honeysuckle Rose. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says we probably don't celebrate Waller enough nowadays, but his centennial is a good excuse to correct that.
African Ripples from 1934. That's one Fats Waller, the piano virtuoso. He got a lot of his flashy technique and driving beat from his mentors, the great stride pianists James B. Johnson and Willie the Lion Smith. They still had one foot in ragtime. Waller had a more modern sense of design, which influenced his own Harlem protege, Bill Basie, years before he was promoted to count. But to the public, Waller was better known as a witty singer who kept up a running comic commentary as he sang. On that score, he owed a lot to black vaudeville star Burt Williams. Here's Williams in 1921.
Oh, there's lots of meaning in that word, unexpectedly. Now, hoot is another one that's not often heard, unexpectedly. Not now, not now. I used to drink gin sup by sup. Then I like to drink it cup by cup. Yeah, Prohibition come along and mess everything up. Sort of unexpectedly. I could have got it in a few bottles, but I didn't think it was going to last.
Fats Waller took Burt Williams' shtick into outer space. As one critic put it, his comic asides appeared set in a hallucinatory world where strange, surrealist notions are pursued.
Check your weapons at the door, be sure to pay your quarter. Burn your leather on the floor, grab anybody's daughter. The roof is rocking, the neighbor's knocking. We're all bums when the wagon comes, I mean the joint is jumping. Let it be, yeah. Don't you hit that chick, that's my broad. Where'd you get that stuff at? Well, I'll knock you to your knees. What? Put this cat out of here. What? Get rid of that pistol. Get rid of that pistol. Yeah. Get rid of it. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Oh, man, it's really ready. No, baby, not now. I can't come over there right now.
As a great jazz musician and great entertainer, Waller's only rival was Louis Armstrong. The sheer joy of playing jazz blasts through like a foghorn on The Joint Is Jumpin'. But even without the laughs, he'd have been a great singer for superb rhythm and pleasing light baritone.
Gotta get my old tuxedo dress. Gotta sew a button on my vest, cause tonight I've got to look my best. Lulu back in town. Gotta get a half a buck somewhere. Gotta shine my shoes, slick my hair. Got to get my soul bootin' there. Lulu's back in town. You can tell all my pets, all my Harlem coquettes, Mr. Otis regrets that he won't be around. You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
Fats Waller's more thoughtful side came out when he sat down at the pipe organ. There, his floating sense of time and underwater tone quality gave his blues a disembodied, dreamy quality. His organ solos made a perfect fit when director David Lynch used them on the soundtrack to his surreal classic, Eraserhead. Fats Waller with Alberta Hunter. This music comes from the Waller set The Centennial Collection from RCA Bluebird, a long CD plus a short DVD of Waller film clips and soundies, those precursors to music videos where he proves a black entertainer could roll his eyes and keep his dignity. At the piano, his head danced for his whole body, and he had the most expressive eyebrows this side of Groucho Marx.
Everyone to be filled with jealousy when they see you out with me. Don't blame them, goodness knows, honeysuckle rose. When you pass by flowers, fruit, and I know the reason why. You're much sweeter, goodness knows, honeysuckle rose. I don't buy sugar, you just have to touch my cup. You're my sugar, so sweet when you stir it up. When I'm taking no sips from your lips, does the honey drip, mercy, perfection,
goodness knows. You my honeysuckle rose, yeah.
Since Waller recorded for RCA for almost his whole career, the CD selection could have been better. There are some rarities and neglected gems, but no organ solos or organ group numbers, nothing by his big band, and few of his own great tunes. Missing songs include I'm Crazy About My Baby, Blue Turning Gray Over You, and The Jitterbug Waltz, but between the two discs, Your Feet's Too Big turns up three times. RCA in the States rarely does right by Fats, having abandoned both the LP and CD Waller reissue series they started. Luckily, as recordings are out of the copyright period in Europe, where labels like Chronological Classics have done rather better by the birthday boy, who 70 years ago played some fancy stuff modern pianists still can't touch.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, The Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. He reviewed Fats Waller, the Centennial Collection, on RCA Bluebird. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Pettis Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
That ain't the cleaner. It is. Yes, yes. I'll polish the leaves, make them green again, shake out the trees, change the scene again. Spring cleaning, getting ready for love. Sweep out the nook, down in Lover's Lane, turn on the brook, make it run again. Spring cleaning, getting ready for love. Dust off the wintry bowers, wash them off with April showers, cover them with fragrant flowers, shine up the silvery moon, cause you and I have a rendezvous under the sky, like we used to do, spring cleaning, get ready for love, yeah.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Trouble with Girls, stories about the romantic education of an ordinary guy looking for love by Marshall Boswell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a real-life Ace Ventura, our postponed interview with Kat Albrecht, who uses trained dogs, behavior profiling, and probability theory to track down lost pets. She has a new book, The Lost Pet Chronicles. Join us for the next Fresh Air.